Hi everybody, today is Monday, June 30th, 2025, and our friend Colonel Jacquebeau is back with us. Colonel, June's gone. And welcome back, Colonel.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me.
I want to start with what has happened in the Middle East. And when the war started, when Israel attacked Iran, I somehow thought that Israel is writing a check. Israel's ego is writing a check that its body can't cash. But you look at what has happened between Iran and Israel and the interference of the United States in final stages of the conflict. Yeah. Donald Trump attacked Iran, said, "We obliterated everything. They cannot do anything with their nuclear program. And let's talk." And we had the Iranian attack on the American base in Qatar. And yesterday we've learned from Ali Larijani, who's a very close, and he's one of the main advisors of the Iranian Supreme Leader, said we have fired 14 missiles at the base in Qatar, and 7 or 6 of them have hit the target. What has happened when you look at the conflict, the way it started, in it advanced, progressed until the end, and there is no end to what has happened. But if we assume that we have some sort of cessation between the two parties, what's your take on that? Who was the winner? Who was gaining more from what has happened?
Well, the question asking who is the winner is not a good question, because victory is defined by the objectives you have defined. That tells you, if you reach the objective, then you win. If you don't, you know. And in that case, we have to see that the Israel who attacked Iran first had some objectives. The question is, did he reach the objectives? I think Israel had two main objectives, and a third one, which is also important, but probably not as important as two first ones. The two first objectives were A, to create a political crisis in Iran, and that obviously failed. And it failed because, and it's interesting because when you listen to, especially in France, for instance, where you don't have much real analysis on the conflict and probably little knowledge of the actors. But in any case, when you hear what you have on mainstream media, you have the feeling that the idea of attacking Iran would be followed almost immediately by a collapse of the government, because 80% or more of the population hates the regime, and therefore that the if you remove, you decapitate, literally, from the Latin to remove the head, if you remove the head of the government, that would allow the country to explode, literally. And it's interesting to see that this didn't happen at all. On the contrary, all the reports I've seen show that, in fact, you had, regardless of the political view and the individual view, the view of individuals, you had a kind of strengthening of the national fabrics, if you want, of the country. Even you had a very strong condemnation coming from the Iranian Jewish community, you know, and the leaders of the Jewish community in Iran condemned vehemently the salvage. Actually, they use the word savage attack of Israel. So meaning that Israel didn't achieve this objective to destabilize Iran and create a political crisis there. Interestingly enough, they seem not to have abandoned the idea of killing Khamenei, but that's probably for another topic. In any case, this objective of creating a political crisis was not achieved. The second objective was to involve the US in the conflict in the Middle East, which is essentially a constant of the Israeli foreign / security, national security policy since the early 50s, and we have mentioned that already on your channel. So this has been always a constant effort of Israel to make, to try to make the US to be permanently involved and physically involved in the conflict, not just with some ships cruising in the Middle East, in the Persian Gulf or in Mediterranean, but to have troops physically on the ground. That was the purpose of the Gulf War, thing like this. Now, this time, we have seen that the US got involved, but very reluctantly. And I would say with the US that provided a minimal service to the Israelis, meaning that they attacked a few centers. We don't know exactly what is the extent of the damages, and there are a lot of speculations around, and we can talk about this later, but I mean, factually, we don't know exactly, and I think only the Iranians at this stage are able to define exactly what happens and the extent of the damage and the consequences for the future. For the rest, we don't know. But apparently, the damages were, again, I have to be very prudent here because I don't have more indication than anybody, but my view is that this was limited. Probably it had consequence, probably it touched some sensitive equipment, but it doesn't seem to be a full-fledged attack on Iran. You see, you have on three sites, and on one site, probably the one that Isfahan, that could have been probably the most very vulnerable. They only used Tomahawk missile that apparently provided only superficial damages. In any case, we have seen that Trump has done that a little bit as kind of a homework he has to do to please both Netanyahu and probably some neocons in the US government, and that was it. And after that, he claimed a big victory, and that reminded me a little bit what my mother used to do when we were fighting against each other as kids. You know, we're fighting, and I won, and the other, my sister said, I won, and everybody won, and everybody lost. And to calm things down, my mother used to say, you have both won. And that's exactly what we have seen here. That was more a question of making everybody happy. I mean, the Israelis are happy because they won. I mean, we destroyed this, and it was spectacular and fantastic, and Netanyahu is the bravest of the bravest. And at the same time, you had this response from Iran, which was, in fact, designed to be limited. But it was bragged as a fantastic victory, and of course Iranians alarmed before, and that's very fair, and all that. So everybody was a winner. And in my view, this approach, which I can understand from a human point of view, if you want, because Trump doesn't want to have this kind of conflict. Again, his priority is to make America great again. And to do that, he has to concentrate its efforts on China. And therefore, dispersing efforts on conflict in Ukraine, Palestine, and Iran, all that is distraction from its main objective. And that's the reason why he would like to solve that. Not to solve the problem. I think that's important. But he wants to have silence. He doesn't want to have this conflict anymore. This shouldn't be that shouldn't be a handicap for his main to reach his own objective. And therefore, he wants to get rid of them. Without, by the way, it's interesting. Without, and that's valid for the three conflict. Without looking for a long-term solution, a real peace for this conflict. He just wants to have silence for now. There was a silence in the room so that he can continue his work. That's a little bit what I feel. But at least someone tries to do it. I mean, we have to acknowledge that because others don't. So the attack on Iran was the minimal service, though it's something against international law. And that also, I mean, that I think an important take of this the sequence we have just seen is the total collapse of the international law-based order. This law-based order that was created after World War II has totally collapsed. We have those who claim to defend values and whatever have breached these the basic rules of the UN Charter for committing war crimes, because attacking civilian nuclear facilities is a war crime, without any reaction from any European or Western country, meaning that all these countries have tacitly accepted, as they accept the massacre of children and women and elder people in Gaza. So it's not new. We have seen that in the past, but here we have a blatant example of the collapse of the international. And in addition to that, to add to that, on top of this, you have the IAEA that has failed in fulfilling its mandate, has demonstrated a corrupt leadership, and has demonstrated its inability to implement the principles of what you have in the UN Charter. I mean, beyond its tasks, the principle of objectivity, neutrality, impartiality, all that was collapsed. And we have seen that already with the OPCV during the Syrian war, where the OPCV, I mean, for the Office Against the Proliferation of Chemical Weapons. This was also demonstrated its inability to solve the problem, to be part of the problem, in fact. We have seen that in Zaporozhye, in Ukraine, with the IAEA. So we have, in fact, what we have seen is not new, but this time it came in plain light, in full light. And that is, in my view, extremely disturbing. So that's what I can say. There's a third objective of the Israelis, that was to destroy the nuclear capacities. And that then comes to the question whether the US and the Israelis, because both tried to hit the civilian facilities, whether it was successful or not, and if they reached the objective, whether they would be able to destroy significantly Iranian capacities, yes or no. We don't have the exact response to that. And of course, it's very dangerous today to take a position, because today we have those who say, well, Iran, Israel was not, and the US were not able to achieve the objective, so Iran won. And you have exactly the neocons coming on that, say, well, that's why we have to strike back and to strike again, you know, not again. So that's why I would discourage people to decide today without factual basis to say who was the winner and if the Israelis and the U.S. achieved the objective of destroying nuclear facilities and things like this. So we, and there is also something linked to that. We have seen, and that was apparent during the whole crisis, as we have already discussed during True Promise 1 and 2, and as we have seen during the Gaza war, and as we have seen in the Ukrainian war, that the West, in that case, it's mostly the US and Israel, have a constant habit to disregard and to underestimate the enemy. And because they underestimate the enemy, they attack with the idea that this will be, I mean, they have higher expectations of the result than the reality brings. Because, again, they always think, and that's what I have mentioned about the Iran, for instance, that it's on the verge of collapsing, and everybody is ready to make the revolution, and. But this didn't happen. Again, the weakness of Israel, in particular, and the U.S. at large, is that they tend to underestimate the capacities and the capabilities of their enemies. They consider the rest of the world, but again, this is a cultural issue. This is a cultural issue. This is nothing else. They consider that the rest of the world is
incompetent.
More than incompetent. Remember that as to the Palestinian, the word human animals was used. And that shows that they are so highest esteem of themselves that they tend to disregard the mere existence or the mere intelligence of others. And even the Palestinians, with no real international support, with limited funds, with limited armament, with limited resources, managed to, I would say, resist successfully, and even inflict, I would say, strategic, not necessarily tactical, but strategic defeat on IDF. Just because by considering your enemy as an idiot, you don't think your action thoroughly. And that's happened exactly the same thing with Iran this time. And we can see that with the time, although the Iranians have, in essence, used the same pattern as we have seen during True Promise 1 and 2. This is exactly the same pattern. The only difference is that during Promise 1 and 2, we had this, the whole pattern of the Iranian response concentrated on one day. This time, this was diluted over 12 days, but it's exactly the same pattern. And it's fascinating to see that apparently the Israelis have not learned from the first two opportunities to learn. And it came out that apparently Netanyahu was surprised to see the response of the Iranians. And the Iranians, and always it was widely publicized, so it's not an invention of me. It was written. I mean, if you read Middle Eastern media, specialized media, specialized in geopolitics and military matters, you could see that the strategy of Iran was explicit. And it was the idea of dragging Israel into an attrition war. And apparently the Israelis didn't anticipate that at all. And that's the reason why there is a point where Netanyahu had to to call daddy, literally, to call daddy to help, because he was failing and he could sense that what he started was a failure, because when designing the attack, they didn't anticipate this kind of response. And that shows this inability of the Israelis. The Israelis are very much exemplify the problem, but we can see the same with other Western countries. This inability to consider that Iran, in that case, but you can apply that to China, to India, or to Russia, it's the same thing. These are countries that are highly educated, that have a huge tradition in resilience, in leadership, in knowledge management, not in the modern sense, but in the sense of using existing capabilities, especially academic capabilities and all that. And this inability to understand that the Iranians, because they were the target of so many verbal and economic attacks in the past 30 years, that they prepared for that. And in 30 years, this is more than one generation in terms of human life, meaning that they had the time to create not just to build weapons, but also to create this intellectual base, this industrial base, this engineering base, this all these aspects to build up a system of defense that we have seen in materialized in the resilience of the country. And the fact that the West is not able to understand that strikes me literally, because this was written. I mean, this was explicit. This was there. But we are blinded by our arrogance. And that's very true with the Israelis. And that will probably lead to their total defeat at one point, because when you're having, it's good to be self-confident, and we have to be self-confident, but too much is too much. Very self-confident is good, but too much is too much. And that's exactly what we have seen. And that's exactly what, in fact, what we have seen in that last sequence is, in fact, reminiscent to the arrogance we have seen of the West attacking Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and all that, where they never managed to have the situation under control at no point, at absolutely no point. They killed a lot of people. They made a lot of destruction. But there is a total inability to gain control over a situation.
Yeah. Colonel, what has happened in Iran in this sort of war, 12 days of conflict? I saw something happening the same way that was happening to Russia during the war in Ukraine. They started this, that this is because whenever we talk about Iranian society, many people don't understand how complicated is the Iranian society. How we have liberals, we have those pro-West, they want to negotiate, they want to find some sort of solution. We have those people who are against the West. They see nothing coming out of discussions. We have people in the middle. They don't know what would be the better attitude to go and find some sort of solution with the West. But what has happened during the conflict is somehow unified those people who were advocating for talks, negotiations, more part cooperation with IAEA, with the United States to ease the sanctions on Iran. We cannot ignore the way that sanctions have been somehow influencing the lives of people in Iran. But after all, these people were advocating to negotiate, to find to do diplomacy. But when it comes to you're negotiating, they're attacking you while they're trying to pretend that they're negotiating with you. It somehow brought all these factions of society together. All of them are united against the aggression. And we had, by the way, if the West was somehow wise, if the United States together with the Israelis, I don't know who was the mastermind of Israeli attack on Iran, but it's not that much difficult to understand what has happened in Russia. This is Putin's war. This is not Russian. The Russians don't want to go to war with Ukraine. And we saw as time went by, the Russian society getting more united with the leadership, with the president of Russia. I saw this happening like much faster in the Iranian society because they have been in the aftermath of the war between Iran and Iraq, we haven't seen anything, any sort of attack, external aggression on Iran. And this was something new to the society who somehow lost its memories about the war with Iraq. These are new generations who wanted to do something with the West, who wanted to find some sort of solution with the West. But it seems that if the United States together with Israel decide to continue this conflict, everybody would remember that Iran was negotiating while they planned an attack and attacked Iran. To destroy Iran, to somehow bring the leadership down, to do regime change. We know that what has happened in Syria, the outcome, it's so obvious for the people of Iran. What do they want to do with Iran? They want to break it down as it was in Russia, into federations, into oblasts. Your take on that?
Well, you know, there are many factors. I mean, many ways to answer your question, because first of all, in the West, we don't understand this region. I think you know that the Iranians are not Arabs. But for a lot of people, this is the same thing. They don't make a difference between a Persian and an Arab. You know, this is the Middle East. They are all Arabs. They are all Muslims and period. You know, this is as simple as that. And don't underestimate the stupidity of people. Don't underestimate the stupidity and the ignorance. I think this is a French prime minister who used to say that. Don't underestimating stupidity. Because a lot of people don't know. These people, they have never traveled, never been there. They don't understand. And we have to see that Iran has, especially in the modern part of Iran's history, Iran has always tried to get closer to the West. They have seen the West as a model somehow, and they always tried to get closer to the West. The problem is that just after World War II, we were still in this kind of colonial mentality, especially from the West. So nobody paid attention to that. And you had new forms of colonialism that developed and that extended over the whole Middle East. But one thing we shouldn't forget. Iran is something like more than 2,000 years old country, and probably more. And when I say 2,000, it's not like Israel, who is a mythical country. And even if the Israeli says 2,000, we used to exist 2,000 years ago. Well, that's written in the Bible, but nobody can certify this. And in fact, a lot of scientists argue that it was not the reality. In any case, Israel disappeared and reappeared, and today it's just a pretext, period. Iran, on the contrary, was a country and has remained a country for so long time. It has reduced in size for a while, and the size, what we the Iran that we see today on the map, is basically the Iran we had at the end of the 18th century. It has not changed. It has not attacked its neighbors. It has remained as a entity with its institutions, with its society, with its mixed society and all that. So this is a country as we could say France or another country in that sense. If you look at the rest of the Middle East, all these countries are barely 100 years old. And they didn't exist before. Again, Iran existed in a larger form, if you want, before. And what we have since 200 years, it's the actual, let's say, borders of somehow. But if you look at countries like Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, they didn't exist. Israel is even questionable because they have no borders. So we can even question its legal existence, but it's another question. All these countries didn't exist. Iraq, Kuwait, even Saudi Arabia didn't exist as such. They were just tribes that were organized at the beginning of the 20th century in order to fulfill the ambitions of some states like UK, France in particular. But these countries didn't exist as such. Therefore, here when we talk about Iran and the rest of the Middle East, we have a completely different, we should have a different way to see this country, but we don't, because most people don't know. Second aspect is that the picture we have of Iran today is largely the picture that was in fact created by the US after the 1979, I mean after the collapse of the Shah regime and the government of the Ayatollah Khomeini and followers. And of course, the whole issue there is that the US was losing its one of its main, let's say, strongholds in the Middle East. And therefore, they had to demonize Iran as a country and Iranians at large. And that's exactly what happens with the support of independentist or separatist movements in the Kurds and the Baluch and the Awazi and others in the country in order to destabilize the country. And that's the picture we have. Again, I have never lived in Iran. I don't know Iran more than what I can read, but I read not just in one direction, I read in all direction, and I try to have the most comprehensive picture of the society. My understanding is that it's very hard to understand a culture when you are not part of it, and when you have not, let's say, when you have not been in the country itself for the longer period of time, especially when it comes to those countries that have a very different culture, mentality, logic, I mean, you name it, than we do in the West. I've lived in other countries outside of Europe, especially in Africa, North Africa, and all that. So I'm aware of the fact that you cannot just look at the country from far away and make a judgment. Societies are much more flexible than we tend to portray them. They are more resilient. And even if we portray these countries, and that applies to Russia, to China, to Iran, and others, we want to portray them as dictatorships because it's convenient for them, for us. It gives us the pretext to be to consider them as enemies because of our values, which should be defined, by the way. But anyway, but in reality, and that's something that I have said many times. You know, I'm Swiss. France is just next door. But if I, and both countries claim to be democracies, if with my Swiss eyes I look at France, I see a monarchy, an electoral a dictatorship, the monarchy. Because the way the country is ruled is something that has nothing to do with what I know in Switzerland. But both countries define themselves as democracies. So what is democracy? For me, France is closer to dictatorship than to democracy, again, with my Swiss eyes. And the fact that French people is able to elect their dictator makes no difference in the way the dictator behaves, you see. So when you see this example of two countries that are just next door, they're touching each other, how can you make a judgment on a system like Iran? And I've lived in countries that are considered as dictatorship. And what I noticed, is that in fact the reality, especially in the Middle East and in Africa, realities are not just black, white. You have all the shades of gray when you, even in the way you manage the country, you make decisions and all that. You take into consideration a lot of factors that we tend to ignore in the West. So this contributes, this picture that we have of Iran, which in my view is extremely distorted, prevents us to have a sane judgment of the country. And what you just mentioned, that instead of splitting the country, the Israeli and US attacks on Iran in fact just strengthened the national unity, is to me no surprise. Because one factor, and again, you are not the first one who said that. I've read that on many articles I've seen, that despite even the existence of opposition and people who disagree with some laws and all that, as we have in the West, by the way, nobody agrees with all the decisions that are made, even in Switzerland, where we decide on our own laws. You know, you have opposition, and you have an opposition in Iran the same way. But beyond this kind of opposition, you have something that, because of history, and that's why I mentioned history before, because of history, you have a national pride. You have a sense of what nationality is. You have the sense of belonging to something which has not been created out of nothing, but which is a reality since 2,000 years. a reality, not a fantasy found on the Bible. You know, a reality. And that's exactly what happened, is that people, because I mentioned before that even the Jewish minority protested against Israeli strikes against Iran. Because, again, despite the fact they be in another religion, by the way, I think in Iran you have the largest Jewish community outside of Israel in the Middle East.
Yeah,
I may be wrong, but I think it's that. In any case, what you see there is two things. First of all, that the Iranians are not anti-Semitic as you tend to think when you hear people like Netanyahu and others. Point one. Point two is that this Jewish community seems to be fully integrated in the society. It's part of the society. Despite having another religion, it is a community which is integrated in the society. And that's the same. I have seen, in fact, in many Muslim countries, that the tolerance towards the Christians, I talk about the Christians because I'm a Christian, and therefore that's what I feel when I see. And I've seen that the tolerance towards the Christian was extremely high. And in fact, even more, I would say, it's respectful. Because what the, let's say, extremists Muslim hate, this is not the Christian or the Jews and all that. This is the apostate. Apostasy is the highest crime, not being Christian or Jew. Apostasy is the highest crime. If for an extremist, I'm not talking about the average people, I'm talking about the extremist. So the average people, he looks at you as an equal. You just believe differently than he does. But I think I have mentioned this anecdote at one point that I experienced when I was dealing with the Muslim brothers in Sudan, that I established very good contact with them just by saying that Muslim Brotherhood, yes. Yes, it was an extremist faction of the Muslim Brotherhood in Sudan. And because we were threatened terrorist attacks and things like this, and then I was head of intelligence for the UN at that stage, so I went in touch with them just to clarify the situation. And I noticed that I had an excellent contact with them just because I said that we have the same God. That's it. We have the same God. And I think this is what we tend to, in fact, in our countries, we tend to be more racist than they are. You know, and what happened in Iran is something which is very familiar when the community is attacked. Instead of splitting, they tend to put their efforts together and to confront the threat together. And that's exactly what we have seen. And the fact that the Israeli cannot understand that, we mentioned previously the Israelis, the US, and all that. And it's not a coincidence. The Israelis come from Europe. They don't have any cultural tie with the Middle East. Any. All these politicians that you have in Israel, in fact, have Polish, Hungarian, Russian, or Ukrainian name. I don't know now all the, but in fact, they changed their name in order to look like Middle East people. But Netanyahu, this is not his real name. You know, all these people like Ben-Gvir and all that, they don't, Smotrich either. This is not their real name. It's an adjusted name because they have, Netanyahu originates from Poland. Ben-Gvir is also from Ukraine or something like that. And Smotrich also from Belarus. So, and anyway, I may be wrong with all that.
Smotrich is Ukrainian, Carl.
Sorry?
Smotrich is Ukrainian.
It's possible. Yes, I probably confused them because, at one point I should study that in more detail. But in any case, this is exactly that. So these people, they don't have the cultural background of the region. They come with a cultural background that comes from Central Europe. And that's the reason why they cannot understand this area where they claim they belong to since 2,000 years. They have nothing in common with what you have in the region. And that's, I think, is one of the factors that explains this inability to understand their adversary. It's also an inability to address, because when you don't know your enemy, you tend to have an aggressive stance instead of trying to talk to him. It's normal human behavior, probably. The problem is that when you are at the level of a state, that you don't play with your foreign policy tools in order to integrate yourself in the regional community. And that's very strange, that since its inception, Israel has never managed to have a national security policy based on good relation with its neighbors. It has always looked at its neighbors like enemies, and therefore had a kind of an antagonistic posture towards its enemies. That's very interesting. And what is even more interesting is that nobody seems to question that. You know, even among, you have a few intellectuals that question that, but there are only a few and probably just in some universities. But there's barely an influence on Israeli foreign policy. And even today, where you have Israel in the middle of a crisis with Lebanon, a crisis with Syria, a crisis with Egypt, a crisis with Palestinians, a crisis with Iran. Who has, let's say, take the initiative for having a dialogue or trying to have a dialogue? The US, not Israel. You never talk about the Israeli foreign policy. I mean, you hear them when they complain in a UN General Assembly, that's all. But you have apparently no action of the Israeli foreign policy in trying to solve problems, to talk to others. And one of my experience in the region is that, is there something you can do always with the Middle East is talking about something before struggling and trying to fight. So there is a fundamental issue there that is very strangely, but not very surprisingly, the Israelis have never grasped this idea that the best result you can achieve in terms of security is not to be the strongest and have the biggest army and all that. And in fact, we see that it's failing. The best way to achieve security is to have good relations with people, talk to them. And dialogue is, in fact, the best security. That's very strange that, well, we see exactly the same thing happening in Ukraine, by the way, that instead of trying to solve the problem by negotiation, as the Russians tried to promote and try to implement with the Minsk Agreement and others. The Europeans are not so keen to talk. They fight. They provide new weapons. You know, this is the EU foreign policy with Kai Kallas has never managed to have any kind of influence on all these conflicts. Instead, I mean, the only way she took influence was to promise to provide weapons. That she is able to do. So there is a fundamental issue here that I think is worth mentioning.
I think before wrapping up, Carl, I think we have to consider when we look at Israel, when I see Iran, I remember the president of Iran, the foreign minister of Iran, Israel, you look at the countries in Europe. But when you look at Israel, the only thing that you know is Benjamin Netanyahu and the defense minister of Israel. No one else is in the picture. There is no policy. There is no foreign policy. It's a policy of war, making new conflicts, making new problems. I don't know if there is anybody in the United States to perceive that, to understand that this sort of attitude and this sort of behavior is not sustainable. This little country cannot fight in each and everybody.
Well, yeah, that's exactly what I said. You know, a security policy, essentially, regardless of the country, is based on the two pillars. I've mentioned that already. The defense policy defense policy / strategies and foreign policy / strategies. These are the two pillars. And you play alternatively with one and the others. That's exactly what we see at play with the Russians, who use this Clausewitzian principle that war is a continuation of politics with other means, meaning that you're playing with those two pillars alternatively or simultaneously in order to achieve your result. Now, when you look at the Europeans today, probably not 50 years ago, but today, as you see with Israel, they have totally forgotten the pillar related to foreign policy. Everything is based on the defense policy. Everything. And they don't even consider that their problem could be solved through diplomacy. And you never hear about the Minister of Foreign Affairs. I mean, you mentioned that regarding Israel, but you can say exactly the same about Germany, for instance. Well, you had Annalena Baerbock, but this was just an additional warmonger it was definitely not diplomacy. So that's where you have this the problem. Now, the problem is that the reason why the US and probably no European countries paid attention to that is probably because during the Cold War, Israel was kind of an advanced position of the West in the Middle East. And if you look at what you had after, let's say, in the late 40s and up to the early 80s or mid 80s at least, you had this kind of Western country surrounded by enemies of the West. Enemies in a broader sense, because there were some in some way related to either Soviet Union or the non-aligned movement, which for the US was considered as enemy because you are either with us or against us. And even Switzerland had hard time to use its neutrality because the US tried many times to put Switzerland into the situation where they had to choose between the East and the West, and Switzerland stayed firm on its neutrality. But that's just to explain that during the Cold War, it was this idea of a kind of a black-white system where you are either with us or against us. And Israel was, in that sense, the advanced position of the West. Rightly so, because other countries were, as I said, enemies, I mean, not enemies, but let's say not very favorable to the West. But today we have a completely different situation. After the end of the Cold War, all these Middle Eastern countries have more or less established strong ties with the West for many reasons. Look at Saudi Arabia, look at, we can even say Syria after what has changed. Egypt, Jordan, even Iraq to some extent, even if they are definitely not totally in favor of the US, but and of course the Emirates and all that. I mean, the whole context of the Middle East has changed, and I would suggest that in that new context that has emerged since 30 years, Israel is no longer the only advanced position of the West. So it has lost its strategic value. The problem is that the Israelis have not realized this. And we see that because Trump, who is a pragmatic person, who tends to act tactically without a strategy, he reacts on opportunities. He's a businessman. I mean, it's very the type of business you may find in New York. You jump from opportunity to opportunity. That's exactly what he does. There is no elaborated strategy and things like this. This is just opportunity and the next opportunity and all that. And in that context, he has established stronger ties with Saudi Arabia, for instance. Remember, recently, as he was there, he was promised an investment of $600 billion or whatever. And you know. So we see that the importance of Israel, which is, in fact, almost, not exactly 100%, but it's largely supported by the US and other Western countries, that would probably not survive economically just based on its own capacities. Israel is a cost. There is no benefit beyond having kind of a moral interest in supporting Israel. There's no real interest supporting Israel today. And I think that will become more and more so. And especially now that we see that Israel, which used to be this invincible fortress, Western fortress in the Middle East, is in fact not invisible, has become a weak point of the West in the Middle East, has become the problem. You know, if we have today a conflict that develops around this issue with Palestine or with Lebanon or with Iran, this conflict would develop around Israel, and that would jeopardize other project, investment project promised by other countries and countries that are ready to cooperate with the West. So essentially, Israel has become a liability and no longer a benefit from the West. And I think Israel should think about this, because then that would probably help Israel to play more with its second pillar of the national security policy, instead of relying exclusively on the defense policy and an aggressive stance towards its neighbors. Probably, I would suggest that for Israel, it would be a good idea to elaborate on foreign policy and develop more better ties with its neighbors, try to solve problems related to the Palestinians, and solve them intelligently based on the international law and not just based on gut feeling as they do now. And that would probably be the best guarantee for the survival of Israel. You know, you cannot, as you said, it's unsustainable to have a security policy exclusively based on defense. And we have seen that, that's been exemplified by the sequence we just saw last week, or in the last 2 weeks, because we have seen that Iran was able to exhaust Israeli capabilities and capacities very quickly, and that Israel was in fact a paper tiger. And because nobody talks about the number of Israelis that have left the country and have said they would not come back. And probably those who left the country are probably those who can afford that. Meaning they are probably those with some kind of level of education or ability in business or innovation and things like this. And they have seen that probably Israel is no longer the best place to develop their talents. And there are probably other places in the world where they can develop their talents. Therefore, you may well have a country that has been deserted by its elites and just left with those people who, in fact, are probably those extremists whose intellectual level doesn't appear to be extremely high if you listen to them and the way they behave and the way they consider other nationalities or minorities. I am not sure a country can consider a future just based with people like this. That's my personal view. I might be wrong, but that's my personal view. In any case, we see that the capacities of Israel are definitely not unlimited. And this, what Iran, and that's where I think Iran has, in fact, somehow won the conflict, to come back to your first question, because it demonstrated that Israel is not this country that has unlimited power. And if a country or its neighbors wanted to destroy it, it could be easily done. And I think that's the lesson we should, especially, I mean, we at large in the West, but also Israelis, should draw from this episode. It's a very unfortunate episode, which has cost a lot of lives for nothing, that has only contributed to degrade the perception of Israel in the world, which was not good, because as we had those exchange of missiles and as the world was focused on counting missiles on both parts, Israeli tanks shot at Palestinians who were waiting for food in Gaza. And apparently, according to Haaretz, they were ordered to do so, meaning firing at children and women waiting for food was apparently an order given to them. No country can be respected after that. This is Israel behave, the way it behaves is a dishonor from the whole humanity. As a former military, I felt almost dishonored to see people with a uniform behaving like this. This is not the way a soldier behaves. And that's something that, Of course, we are talking just about the last couple of days. But this has happened since, in fact, decades. That was a little bit more apparent after the 7th of October 2023. But in fact, during decades, we had this abuse of power that is a dishonor for a military. That explains why you have less and less young Israelis who want to serve in the military. And that shows that probably there is something more fundamental that is rotten within the state of Israel, which is probably the sense of honor, the ethics, the morale, the sense of discipline, and the good common sense. Anyway, that's my analysis for today.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Carol, for being with us today. Great pleasure as always.
That's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me again.